This is the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast, episode 106. Why do distressing and harmful resident-to-resident incidents in nursing homes occur? The Nursing Home Abuse Podcast is dedicated to providing news and information for families whose loved ones have been injured in a nursing home. Here are your hosts, Georgia attorneys Rob Schenck and Will Smith. Hello out there and welcome back. My name is Rob Schenck.
And I'm Will Smith.
And today we're going to be talking about a very important topic, and that is incidents, physical incidents that occur between nursing home residents that result in injury and death.
Mm-hmm. And we are purposely choosing our words carefully because our guest today, Dr. Alon Caspi, is a researcher in the field of resident-on-resident incidences. And he's very particular about, and rightfully so, very particular about the terms that we use. So that's why we're not saying resident-on-resident fight.
Violence.
Or violence.
Aggressor.
Because these, and as he will explain, these have certain elements to them that are prejudicial and biased.
Certain connotations. That's right. Yeah. So as I will mention later, I saw him first at the National Consumer Voice give a presentation on the study, and it actually educated me on the nomenclature and the vocabulary to use. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. And I was like, we got to have him on the show. So we're really glad that we're getting him out here. But, Dr. Caspi is conducted a study, and he'll talk about it a little bit more. He'll elaborate on it when we get him on, but he, has done a study of, I think, over 150 incidents between nursing home residents that resulted in injury or death, and he's compiled all this data and has come to some very interesting conclusions and has, you know, some findings that are very interesting. So if you have a loved one that's in a nursing home, this is a good episode for you to listen to. So, Will, what can you tell us about Dr. Caspi?
Well, Dr. Alon Caspi is a gerontologist and dementia behavior specialist. He started working in the aging field in 1994 as a nurse aide in a nursing home where his grandfather lived. Both of his grandmothers had dementia. He later worked as a social worker with elders with low income at the Department of Social Services for elders in the Tel Aviv municipality, and then at a long-term care home for elders with dementia in the city of Jaffa. His work applied research, volunteering, and advocacy, focusing on enhancing the quality of care, quality of life, and the safety of people living with dementia, as well as supporting and educating their family and professional care partners. Over the past decade, he focused in various ways on improving understanding and the prevention of distressing and harmful resident-to-resident incidents in dementia in long-term care homes. His passion is in bridging academia and research with practicality. And we are very honored to have Dr. Caspi on the phone today. Dr. Caspi, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
All right. Yep. Well, Dr. Caspi, we're really happy that you've come on the show. I saw you do a presentation at the Consumer Voice Conference last year in 2018, regarding incidents between nursing home residents. And one of the very first things that I thought was poignant was that you made sure that the words that you use and the words that you would like other people to use are accurate and basically not discriminatory or not prejudicial to the individuals. So I would really, before we even go into the study and the reason why you were talking, I would really like you to comment about why you dislike the use of the word violence or aggressor when it comes to distressful events between residents in a nursing home.
Sure. So I think that for too long, for decades, care staff members, researchers, we've been using language that describes individuals living with dementia and their various behavioral expressions in ways that reflect misconception and ways that are stigmatizing, labeling, misleading, unfair, and frankly harmful to these individuals. I think that it's easy to forget sometimes, especially in the heat of the moment, that these individuals live with a serious brain disease. So what we often see, I mean, there is progress in the field, but what we often still see is that residents with Alzheimer's disease are being labeled aggressive, violent, abusive, combative, etc. And when they are trying to cope to the best of their ability with their remaining abilities, with situations in the social and physical environment that could be very distressing, if not frightening for them. And one of the problems that this approach causes is that it's a slippery slope towards, first of all, the first thing is that staff members are no longer in a position to identify the unmet human needs that often underlie and drive those behavioral expressions. That's number one. And number two, it's a slippery slope, for using antipsychotic medication, that now we really have a problem because now we have a much harder time to identify those unmet human needs.
It's also just not very – I like your perspective on this because as an attorney, in the legal world, especially in the criminal world, one of the elements of crimes of intent is something called mens rea. And it means that you had the mental perspective to commit a crime. You were intentionally doing this. And if you have a brain disease like dementia, you don't know why that person is acting out the way that they are. They don't have the mens rea of somebody like me or you who is intentionally being violent. So it's you're right. This is a much more accurate perspective of it.
Right. Now, and that what you just described is also a barrier for reporting. We can talk about it later for underreporting. Sure. But I think that it's important to recognize that the majority of residents with dementia don't wake up in the morning with a premeditated intent to harm, injure, or kill their fellow residents.
Right.
Now, that said, there are individuals with lifelong personality, types that might be, were violent in the past. And mm-hmm. So we have to also recognize that this exists, and dementia and or serious mental illness could exacerbate that. So we always have to remember that there is a subgroup of individuals that have these tendencies, and they may accelerate, they may escalate in an environment, in a congregate setting, where there's so many stressors on a daily basis, when you're basically forced to be with other residents around you 24/7, sometimes for years.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Caspi, we briefly touched on in your introduction the study that you conducted, the topic of your presentation at the Consumer Voice Conference. Can you tell the audience what your study was about and what were some of the key findings from that study regarding incidents between nursing home residents?
Sure. So because to my knowledge, there is no tracking there's no tracking at centralized administrative or clinical data set that captures those incidents, such as the MDS 3.0 or CMS state survey deficiency process. So there is no FTAC that is specifically for residential incidents. So those incidents are often being captured under broader categories such as abuse, neglect, and accident. But the problem is that they're buried forever there, and it would be extremely difficult to identify those state survey investigative reports. And the same goes with the MBS 3.0, behavioral E-section. It is not possible to differentiate whether the so-called aggressive behavior was directed towards a staff member or towards another resident. So given those major gaps, I decided not to wait until those be breached. And I said, okay, I got to jump into the water here. Let's see what is available and what we can learn from it. Because people are being injured, in a vulnerable population being injured, and they die. It's traumatic for residents. It's devastating for their family members, are often shocked to hear about those serious incidents. And what I did, I was able to locate over 150 newspaper articles with all the limitations that's inherent in newspaper articles, but also dozens of death review records from the province of Ontario in Canada. And I tracked and analyzed them, and I'd be glad to share with you the findings. I have to say that for the most part, for people who work in nursing homes, and I should say also assisted living residences, where these incidents also occur, the findings will not be surprising for the most part. But still, to my knowledge, this is the first study in the United States and Canada that looked at fatal resident threat incidents. And with that, I'll be glad to share some of the findings.
You said fatal, correct?
Fatal. So yeah. My study examined the circumstances surrounding the death of 105 residents in the context of resident-to-resident incidents. So they sustained injuries that contributed to their death. And I have to say that since then, I already learned, this study was published earlier this summer, and since then, I was able to identify at least 2,000 additional fatalities in these incidents. And to be honest, every other week I'm learning about another death or injury due to these incidents. So with that, let me share with you some of the main findings in the study that came up in my review. The first thing is that the exhibitors, for lack of a better word, the resident that whose physical contact with another resident led to the injury and subsequent death, okay? So we're going to use the terms that are not great, but we'll use the term exhibitor and target. And it's not always easy to, it's not always straightforward to differentiate who is the real exhibitor and who is the target. I'm going to talk about it if you want. But in general, exhibitors were on average nearly a decade younger than the target residents. Hmm. Both men and women were equally on the receiving end. They were the ones who were injured and subsequently died. That said, 3/4 of the exhibitors were men, which is not surprising. It's consistent with what we know with previous research on what is called aggressive behaviors in this population. There were 23 deaths occurred when at least one of the residents involved was a newly admitted resident, which I defined a resident that lives in a long-term care home up until 3 months. So we know that the stressors and adaptation to a new living environment for people with dementia may contribute to this incident. In terms of, I was curious to know where those incidents occurred on the floor, in the care home. Close to 60%. I apologize for my voice today. I don't know what happened. Close to 60% of the incidents occurred inside bedrooms. Many of these out of sight of staff members. In terms of time of day, close to 60% occur during the evening or nighttime, 44% during the evening hours, and 38% occur during the weekend. So we all know what should happen during the evening hours and weekends and doesn't always happen, right? In terms of staffing levels, active presence of managers, meaningful engagement, etc. 43% of the incidents occur between roommates. So we need to pay very careful attention to roommates. We can talk about that too. And 62% were not witnessed, were reportedly not witnessed by staff. So we're missing substantial portion of serious residential incidents. And this was also confirmed in another study using video recording in a care home for people with dementia, that 40% of physical residential incidents were not even witnessed by staff.
Wow.
And then I was curious to know what was the nature of the physical contact. And this was a fascinating, I thought that was a fascinating finding. 44% were characterized as push-pull incidents. Again, going back to the stigma, are these really violent, abusive situations, or are these situations when another resident invades another resident's personal space or enters their bedroom when they don't want them to enter it, and they push them away? Okay. Now, if you push me, I might be able to block it or fall in a way that is not injurious. But if you're a 90-year-old resident using a walker and you frail and you have dementia, oftentimes they fall, they break the hip, or have a brain injury, and then their medical condition, physical condition deteriorates, and they may be debilitated or they pass away. And interestingly, a separate study in Australia published a year ago found that 50% of fatal residential incidents were push-pull incidents. So all you need is one push. And that's what staff members, one of the things staff members need to be aware of if they don't already know that. Close to one third of the incidents, a resident using a physical object to in the physical contact with another individual. So, and they're thinking non-traditionally, very creatively, using a hanger on from the closet, a wheelchair footrest, and even a cord of a bedside lamp to strangle another resident. So we have to be extra vigilant and be always kind of looking for objects that could be used to harm another individual, especially with a high-risk subgroup of residents.
I also found it interesting.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Doctor, but I also find it interesting that 3/4 of the exhibitors are, it sounds like they're younger males. But are men equally distributed in the long term care setting, or is it more? Are there more women?
Well, we know that studies vary, but 70 to 80% of residents in nursing homes in America are actually women, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the VA long-term care homes, what they call community living centers, you will find 90, 95 or more percent of the residents are men.
Right.
So very different environment.
Yeah, that's interesting. And but the target is the targets are
generally female.
Generally, well, I think he said they're equally distributed.
Yeah, equally distributed.
Women and men.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Right. And to be honest, we need more studies. I mean,
sure.
A study in 2004 at Harvard showed that actually men were substantially more likely to be injured. So we need more research to kind of shed light on these findings, but the other study looked only on physical injury.
Mm. I got you.
Mm. So Dr. Caspi, if you could, I know you touched on some of the findings in terms of the percentages of exhibitors versus targets, who they are, that kind of thing. And can you kind of explain to the audience? And our audience generally consists of family members who have loved ones in nursing homes. What are some of the things that they can take away from these statistics, what they can take away from this data that will help prevent a distressing or harmful incident involving their loved one?
Well, for those long-term care homes, nursing homes, assisted living, that are not aware of this phenomenon, I mean, not taking proactive steps to address it when we know it's prevalent, concerning, and harmful, I would say that family members, if they are in a position to do it, they should actually educate staff members and administrators. So take my study, for example, and take the study on the injuries and share the main findings with the administrators. and, you know, tell them that those things, for example, tend to happen in the evening hours. What are you doing in the evening hours to strengthen your stopping level? What are you doing in terms of training? What are you doing in terms of risk assessment? So everybody needs to know the risk factors and the protective factors, and we can talk about it, and the common situational triggers. They need to visit regularly if they can, and to pay close attention not only to their loved one, but also to the social interaction that take place between residents. Talk with other family members. Maybe they see something when you're not there, right? Visit during the evening hours and weekends, because there's some tendency for these incidents to occur in the evening hours. Build and maintain close trusting relationships with care staff members so that you have that open communication with them. So when something happens, they will inform you about what happened. And then you can work with the team, with the care team, to understand the unmet human needs and triggers and come up with a strategy to address it. Family should be an integral part of the care planning team in the good nursing home. Remain vigilant and document what you see. Document everything what you see, because that might come useful down the road. And I have things that I think that administrators should take away. If you want, I can share that too.
Oh, absolutely. Please do that.
So I think that the first thing that administrators, those that are not fully aware, they need to recognize that. And the majority of situations, as I mentioned, is unmet human needs and situational frustration and interpersonal stressors and misperceptions and simple misunderstandings that lead and contribute to resident engagement in distressing and harmful resident-to-resident incidents. And with that recognition, we can start working in understanding, recognition, prevention, and de-escalating those incidents on an individual resident basis. It is much easier to prevent those incidents than to de-escalate them when they become serious, right? You have to have adequate staffing levels at all times, evening hours, weekends as well, holidays, of well-trained staff. I think the goal should be close trusting relationship between staff and residents. And when staff members know the resident's life history, they're in a much better position to understand their human needs and to address them proactively. You need active presence of experienced and qualified and trained managers during the evening hours. I'm not talking about a well-meaning nurse who's doing paperwork inside a staff room, but really providing that guidance to the staff members who may be struggling to address those episodes during the evening hours and weekends. One of the secrets for prevention is a robust and personally meaningful engagement program, or others would call activity program. When residents with dementia are personally meaningfully engaged in various activities, you will see substantial reduction of those incidents. That said, if you don't plan the activity well, or it's not delivered professionally, or there's something upsetting in the physical environment, you will see those episodes. But by and large, that's one of the secrets. So invest in your recreation department. Hire people who are qualified and trained. And if you have a strong, meaningful engagement program, you will be able to reduce a lot of those episodes. Open and effective communication across interdisciplinary team members as well as with family members, as we mentioned earlier. Adequate risk assessment, systematic documentation, and use what is called the behavioral expression log. That if it's used systematically by the staff members, you can identify the patterns, those spatial and temporal and other patterns that are the basis for planning of individualized prevention measures. Become a learning organization. Avoid a blame culture. Support and train your staff well. Another critical missing piece is pre-admission behavior assessment. Too often, we're admitting people that we don't have business to admit because it's good for the bottom line. And now we have a resident whose needs are not met, and he or she may put other residents and himself or herself at risk. There was an incident in Toronto, I don't know if you heard about it, it's called the Casa Verde incident near Toronto, and the resident was admitted on an emergency admission during the weekend on a Saturday around noon. At 7 p.m., two of his roommates were severely injured, and he managed to cross the hallway and start attacking another resident. Luckily, there was reportedly a housekeeping staff who was able to de-escalate the situation. They did not know at that point that the two residents in the first room were already dying, or if not dead. So, pre-admission at behavioral assessment is absolutely critical. Accept people that you know to the best of your clinical judgment, of your interdisciplinary team, that you are capable to meet their needs and keep themselves and others safe. The other thing is listen to residents' concerns and fears. Never dismiss what a resident with dementia tells you. Take it seriously because it is not uncommon residents express fear about their roommate, and it's not being taken seriously. And the next thing you know, there's an altercation and there's injury and perhaps a fatality. You have to have a thoughtful roommate assignment and ongoing monitoring because even a friend who's a companion, supportive roommate, may reach a breaking point because of repeated questions or noise at night or, arguments about the window or the door or the lights or the volume of the TV or the light in the bathroom, etc. So pay attention to roommates, as we saw earlier. Identify and treat depression, because depression underlies a lot of those episodes. And also, of course, provide proactive medical assessment and treatment. We know that UTI, which is urinary tract infection, constipation, pain, hallucination, could contribute to these episodes. And there's other things, but I'm going to stop here in case you want to comment or have other questions.
Well, I think everything that you've said, all your findings are extremely significant, of course, doctor. But I think one of the most important things that you've said from my perspective is that prevention is a lot easier than de-escalation. And it sounds like a lot of the advice that you're giving is, pre-admission screening, knowing these residents, having sufficient staff, prevent these situations before they happen. Because, you might be able to de-escalate, but it's a lot easier not having to do that.
And my question, my question, Dr. Caspi, is mm-hmm. what is CMS or is any other organization taking your study and under advisement to potentially change the federal regulations?
Maybe add an F tag.
Yeah, something like that. Are you aware of
right? So aware of? Sorry.
Yeah. Are you aware of any type of move towards that, like changing the EMDS, that kind of thing?
I really want to urge CMS, CDC, Division of Violence Prevention, Government Accountability Office, the USOIG, Office of Inspector General, to finally examine and tackle this phenomena. I hope that soon they will. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, there are no meaningful, comprehensive campaign to address this phenomenon, even though leading researchers such as Professor Carl Pulemer from Cornell University, who conducted the largest number of studies on this phenomenon with his colleague Professor Mark Lass, and Gene Terezi from Columbia University, Professor Carl Pulemer said that we urgently need a national plan to address what he calls violence in nursing homes, and he's asking why do we accept this. Why we don't accept it in childcare settings? Why do we accept it? Why it has become a norm in nursing homes in America? Right. So this is a vulnerable and fair population. They have a human and federal right to live in a safe environment. So far I was not able to convince those agencies despite numerous letters that I wrote, and I hope that it won't take another major tragedy in the nursing home or assisted living for these agencies to take a proactive approach, because leading national experts such as Dr. Correa project that these incidents will increase in the coming years with the retirement of the baby boomers. And I think as a society, we need to start tracking, analyzing, and learning from incidents. I mean, David Wright, who is at a very high level position at CMS, he was the director of Servant Certification Group. I think now they changed the name to Safety and Quality or something like that. Mm-hmm. He said, we CMS do not want to become historians of bed care. We need to analyze situations, and we need to be proactive and inform prevention. And I'm afraid that while they may do it with other phenomena, they have not done it with this phenomena, to my knowledge, yet. And I hope that this will change soon.
That would be fantastic if it did. Dr. Caspi, I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your study. If there's anybody out there that would like to contact you or actually find the study and read it in its entirety, how would somebody contact you, and how would somebody access the study?
Well, do you have my email?
I do. Well, we have it on the screen.
Is there a way to post?
Yeah, but we have your information on the screen, but sometimes most people listen to the program, so we got to hear it spelled out. So
sure.
I can share your...
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's E-I-L-O-N as Nancy, and then C-A-S as Sam, P as Paul, I, so that's my name, first and last name in one string, @gmail.com. Mm-hmm. So eloncaspi@gmail.com. Email me and I will share with you whatever resources I have that you're interested in, within the limitation of respecting publishers' rights.
Right.
But I'm sure we can work something out.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Caspi, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. That was very good information.
And keep fighting the good fight.
Thank you for helping to raise awareness of this phenomenon. And if I can take 15 seconds,
sure, absolutely.
I would like to a shout out to my colleague Judy Berry. And I are working on a short documentary film that we're planning. It was accepted to be screened at the American Society on Aging next April on this phenomenon, an injurious and fatal incident. So if any of the family members who hear this show today, this podcast, are aware or their loved one experienced that and they are willing to share their story with us, we would be more than glad to discuss this with them. We are looking for families who are willing to do that, as long as they are allowed to do it. Some families are in the middle of a lawsuit, mm-hmm. Or investigation, and we don't want to compromise that, because the goal of the documentary film is to raise awareness to the phenomena and to put a human face on the statistics that we're starting to starting to emerge from research studies, and hopefully drive action to address it and keep residents safe.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. So if anybody out there listening, or we'll also pass out the information to the various means that we have, but that's amazing. That's I'm looking forward to seeing that.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, doctor.
Talk to you later.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, and I can't stress enough humbling experience, but it's when you're educated on something that you've been doing inappropriately for a long time. And we, and even in past podcasts, we've described people as aggressors, We've described incidents as violent, and as you mentioned earlier, that's almost like it's placing onto the residents the mens rea that they intended the result of their conduct, and that's not accurate. So we need to, you know, change the way we say these things.
Yeah, because it's a fuller picture of what's going on. I mean, you know, Mr. Johnson may take his fist and hit his roommate in the face. Is it a violence? Is it an act of violence?
Is it fair to say that it's violent? I mean, like,
we don't know what's going through Mr. Johnson's head. If he has a disease like dementia, we don't know what he sees. We can't see through his eyes. Right. He might be reliving something that happened to him, you know, years ago. Mm-hmm. He might think he's trying to help out. The actus reus, the act itself, looks like a fight. But the reality is, if you're trying to figure out what's going on here, you have to take into account that this person may not be intending to cause violence.
We're using a lot of Latin today.
We are.
Actus reus.
Yeah. Well, those are two elements in criminal cases where, you know, you have the premeditated criminal mindset, and then you actually commit the crime.
You know who else used a lot of Latin?
Dr. Spock or Captain Picard?
That's pretty impressive, but that's a miss. You've missed the landing.
Okay.
The individual that I was thinking of was President Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, okay.
Because this podcast episode goes to air.
Yes, it is.
In fact, President's Day. And I believe that President's Day started off as Abraham Lincoln's birthday. Am I wrong about that? I'm probably wrong. Gene?
We'll have to check that with Gene.
Gene doesn't care to spend his time researching this for us.
So it was originally maybe Abraham Lincoln's birthday.
And they combine it with George Washington's to do President's Day.
Okay. I don't know. No idea. It's not something I've ever celebrated knowingly. I've never.
That's interesting, because think about it. Think about it like this. You have, in terms of the national holidays, what are we as a nation saying? Like, we are celebrating the people that have been killed in war for us. That's fine. We are celebrating the people that are just have fought, which is Memorial or Veterans Day. Mm-hmm. And then now we're saying, okay, we're going to honor the presidents. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's the People's Day. It's Labor Day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a national holiday. Banks are closed on Labor Day.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I guess it's fair. Like, it's kind of like there's like the Bosses Day, which I can't get behind Bosses Day. Every day is Bosses Day.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, every day is President's Day. Like, that guy's doing what he wants. Why we got to celebrate?
Well, I don't. Yeah. I feel like it should maybe be Founding Fathers Day. Like, we look back historically at the men who.
See, and I disagree with it. I think that if we're going to do that, it needs to be make Constitution Day a federal holiday.
Well, first of all, I don't think you should ever celebrate any human being ever, because humans, regardless of their accomplishments, are always terrible people.
Wow.
So I don't believe you should have statues of humans. I don't think you should have.
Captain Picard wasn't an evil human being. Only during the times in which he was injected with Borg, I don't know what you would call that.
Borg technology.
And he was Levius? I can't remember. He had a Borg name, even though his name should have just been a number. I can't remember the explanation of why he had an actual name, because they don't have names. They're like 7 of 9, 6 of 10,
Anyway, so
it's President's Day, which, again, I stand as someone that says we should not have that day.
I would agree with that.
So anyway. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can catch a new episode every Monday, even if it's not a holiday. Hot off the presses in the morning. Usually it comes out about 6 a.m., I think, if I can remember correctly. But anyway, you have two ways to watch or consume, actually. You can watch us on YouTube or at our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com, or you can listen wherever you get your podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, these type of places. And with that, happy President's Day, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said on this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal advice, nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes are available every Monday on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.